It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with a guest who's got tips for protecting ourselves against online scammers, hackers, and catfishers.
First, manure has long been used to enhance the nutrients in soil on farms. Applying manure to farmland, however, takes a lot of work.
The typical method, truck it in and spread it out by hand, more or less. But some farms are using pipes or irrigation sprayers to spread the manure. The practice is growing in Wisconsin and elsewhere, and some neighbors are complaining about the smell and worried about contamination of water supplies.
The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism released a report yesterday about that issue.
Ron Seeley joins us now. He's the author of that report. He's an editor and reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and a senior lecturer on journalism and science writing at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Ron, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, did we explain it right? How is this new manure irrigation system working on farms?
You did explain it right. Probably people are most familiar with these irrigation systems if you drive up through central Wisconsin, the sand counties, and you see these big machines moving around the field, spraying water on the fields. They're called central, most of them are called central pivot irrigators. And now what is happening, there are about 14 farms in Wisconsin who have been using those irrigators now to spray not only water, but also manure, a manure-water mixture on the fields.
What's the advantage of using this liquid manure method?
Farmers, and many farmers, do defend this. The DNR also defends it as being better environmentally. Farmer's argument is it's cheaper. You were right when you mentioned that the old method involved, and the method that's still used on most farms, it involves loading the manure from these lagoons where it's stored into a truck, a tanker, trucking it many miles sometimes to a distant field. And spreading it with the truck sprayer on the back of a truck. Sometimes it's transferred to a smaller truck. These new systems, they have pipelines. They've built pipelines from the farm to these fields. Sometimes the pipelines can be 7, 8, 9 miles long. Those pipelines feed this manure water mixture into the irrigators, and the irrigators spray it on the fields.
How widely used is this?
It's not widely used in Wisconsin right now. In fact, it's not widely used really in the upper Midwest. It is used. There are, as I said, about 14 farms in Wisconsin that use it. Primarily, we're talking about the big industrial-sized farms. They're called, the acronym is CAFOs, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. These are operations that can have as many as 9,000 cows and these enormous lagoons filled with manure. And 14 of those farms are using it now, but Andrew Craig with the DNR, who is working with a committee that's studying this practice, tells me that more and more farms are going to be using it, and it's going to become eventually fairly widespread.
So that study's going on, but right now, what does the DNR do, if anything, to regulate this?
It is legal under current law, and the DNR does regulate it. There are what are called setbacks, limitations on how close these systems can be used near homes. They have to be used at least 500 feet away from homes. There are setbacks for wells and so forth. But there are issues that are being discussed right now by a work group. It's being operated by UW Extension with input from the DNR, and there are a number of others, CAFO operators. There are people who actually oppose the practice and oppose CAFOs on the committee, too.
And let's get into the criticism of this this technique, spraying liquid manure on farms. What kind of complaints are you hearing?
Well, first of all, we got to talk a little bit about manure, which seems to be all I've been talking about lately. I started 40 years ago in the business as a farm reporter down in Illinois writing about manure.
So you've come full circle.
I have. 60 years old, and I'm still writing about manure. But there's a lot of it in Wisconsin. There's an estimate made by a former DNR regulator that the volume of manure produced by cattle in Wisconsin is equal to the populations of Tokyo and Mexico City combined. So there is a lot of manure. Now, the issue is this liquid manure that we're talking about is different from the manure that you might have seen on the smaller farms, the solid manure. Because of a lot of the antibiotics and the other substances that they feed, put in the feed of these animals today, the manure is liquid. It's also mixed with water and other materials and pumped into these lagoons. The EPA has estimated there are as many as 160 pathogens in this manure. They do. These pathogens are living things. It's everything from Giardia to Salmonella. Scientists who are studying this right now point out that those pathogens do die when exposed to sunlight and heat. But still, you're spraying a substance that has these pathogens into the air, and oftentimes you're spraying it relatively close to rural subdivisions and places where people live.
And you, in your piece, document some complaints about people who live quite close to farms doing this. The smell itself is something they're very concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, probably anybody who's driven through the Wisconsin countryside in the summer can relate. You just have to imagine living across from one of these places. This manure has ammonia in it. It has hydrogen sulfide in it. And that creates this very sharp, really unpleasant odor. The people I talked to, I documented two cases where individuals who lived across from one of these large farms basically sold their properties and moved because of overspraying and the manure actually getting on their mailboxes, getting on their lawn. There were flies. It was just too difficult. And they thought health problems, breathing problems, ammonia and hydrogen sulfide can cause breathing issues. So they just couldn't take it anymore and ended up leaving.
And you mentioned the concept of overspraying. If I was reading it right, there's a concern that these larger animal operations have these large manure lagoons. They want to get rid of it. And so there's a temptation to spray on fields more than they need to, saturating the fields, creating risks of runoff.
Yeah. You know, it has to be, first of all, said that, you know, in defense of using manure, it is a nutrient. It provides a nutrient to crops, and farmers do depend on it and need it to grow their crops. So, we've been using manure that way forever, and so that in and of itself is not a problem, using it as a nutrient. The problem is the volumes that we have, manure that we have now. And as I pointed out in the story, and this was according to a Nebraska UW Extension study, from the University of Nebraska, sometimes it can be a matter of just getting rid of the stuff because there's so much of it. And these irrigators make it so easy to spray and to spread this stuff that it's very easy to over apply. And then you get ponding, you get, especially in North Carolina and elsewhere in the country, there have been instances where the ground was saturated and farmers kept applying this stuff. And they have, in North Carolina, they had massive fish kills. There is that issue. And of course, when you get into that situation, it increases the risk of polluting groundwater and water supplies, especially in areas where there is fractured bedrock or karst beneath the soil that's being farmed.
Have local or county governments entered the picture to try to regulate this, or is this something that's only going to come from the state?
Some towns and at least one county in Wisconsin have put moratoriums in place until the state takes a harder look at it. This panel will ultimately perhaps make recommendations on whether, for instance, setbacks need to be changed, or there needs to be some more a harder look at tightening up regulations.
And you mentioned that this is largely tied to concentrated animal feeding operations. This issue aside, they've been pretty controversial. There's been a lot of objections to having over a certain number of livestock on a certain size of farm. How much is criticism of this particular practice, the use of liquid manure, tied up with the wider issues surrounding these CAFOs, as they're called?
Yeah, it's really hard to separate the two. As I pointed out in the story, they're really inextricably tied together. The much of the criticism of the practice of using irrigation systems comes from people who are upset with the CAFOs. One of the big concerns and critics of these CAFOs have concerns about losing control. Some people who live near them feel that they have very little control over what the farms do. They're very concerned about enforcement. The DNR has been understaffed and largely relies on citizen complaints to get out and check out problems or potential violations. And people are concerned that perhaps this practice, especially, it's governed by a plan called the Nutrient Management Plan that allows the farmer, under which the farmer controls the amount of manure and how much is being spread and when. And some critics just don't believe the DNR is going to pay close enough attention to protect the landscape.
Ron, we'll track the issue as this study group comes up with solutions on this issue. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Ron Seely, editor and reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, senior lecturer on journalism and science writing at the UW-Madison. These days, we're putting more info about ourselves than ever online. From social media to online dating and everything in between, our internet personas are constantly growing.
But there's a lot of danger out in the digital world, and our online identities can easily come under attack. There are hackers, scammers, predators, and many other online ne'er-do-wells. So how do we make sure we're staying safe when we're using the internet? And how are we keeping our kids safe, too?
Joining us now with some advice is Tyler Cohen Wood, Cyber Branch Chief for the Defense Intelligence Agency under the Department of Defense. She's not speaking for them right now, though. She's the author of Catching the Catfishers, Disarm the Online Pretenders, Predators, and Perpetrators Who Are Out to Ruin Your Life. Tyler, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob and Veronica. It's great to be here.
Well, we spend a lot of time doing stuff online one way or another, but I get the sense a lot of us, and I'll include myself here, we don't think these online identities are important as our real selves. Maybe we don't take it seriously. Are we wrong? Are we ignoring something important here?
Absolutely. In fact, I would go to the extreme and say that our online identities are nowadays even more important than our real identities. Because recruiters, HR recruiters, college boards, any potential employer, potential date, they are doing reconnaissance on you, and they are putting together a perception based on the image that you present online.
Well, it seems like a lot of people act like there's a line, here's the personal stuff I'm doing online, and that's where I'm going to put the drunk party photo, say, and then my professional life is over here, and they're never really going to mix up.
And that, unfortunately, is just not necessarily true. Privacy settings can change at any time, and they do on your social media sites. You really have to start thinking that everything that you post can be accessible by someone that you may not want to see you in that light.
And it's such a moving target, isn't it? Even if I went to the trouble of reading social media sites, say, terms of use agreement and user agreement, I have made it through the 8 pages or whatever, it can just change without me knowing it and the old rules no longer apply. Am I right?
That is entirely true. I mean, I do recommend reading the terms of service and also paying particular attention to the applications that you install on your devices, because a lot of times those applications are privacy risks as well. And what I mean by that, I call it application permission creep, and that is where applications that you have installed on your phone might have access to other more personal applications without you necessarily knowing. Most applications will tell you that they're doing this in the terms of service, or if you look at the permissions of the applications. But what if I were to say, Rob, you and Veronica are having a text message conversation about something that you do not want for anyone else to know. You probably make the assumption that that's personal between just the two of you. But I'm telling you, that's not necessarily the case. And if you look at the permissions of some of the applications that you install, such as Google Hangouts, Google Now, they tell you in their permissions that they have the ability to read your text messages, they have the ability to send text messages, and they also have the ability to sell those text messages to third parties.
I'm guessing that a lot of people using that information are just going to try to sell me stuff, which might be annoying, but maybe doesn't bother me that much. How can the identity we create online help criminals, people who want to rip us off in one way or another?
Well, you have to be really careful with the things that you choose to self-disclose. You might be really careful about never posting your birthday, or you might be really careful about not posting your pattern of life, but it's really easy to put this pattern of life together. And you can see when people will say happy birthday to you on social media sites. And you can see, you know, sometimes there's something called EXIF data, which comes along with modern day photographs. It's something that the cameras do. I teach you in my book how you can actually turn that off. But what EXIF data is it's information about the camera, including the exact geolocation of where that photograph was taken. So if you post that to some social media sites, some social media sites will strip that EXIF data out, but some of them don't. And you could be giving away the location of your house, of your child's preschool, or any of the images that you're posting.
You talk about somebody getting in trouble at Burger King because of the EXIF data. Can you tell that story?
Oh, yes. So this was a guy who he thought he was completely anonymous, and he posts a photograph of himself with his dirty feet in a bucket of lettuce, and he's with a caption saying, "This is the lettuce that you eat at Burger King." And he didn't have any identifying features. It was just his feet. And he posted it to a social media site called 4chan, which does not strip the EXIF data. And within about an hour, people were able to find him. They located him, and he was immediately fired.
So people can put together a lot of information about us based on us, you know, putting fairly innocuous stuff or what seems innocuous. Who is that? Who are the bad people out there trying to collate all this data and use it for what?
Well, there's bad, and then there's also not necessarily bad. So you have commercial entities with big data analytics that want to collect your data to sell it to third parties and to market things to you. Then you have predators who are actually targeting your children for insidious reasons. And then you have people who are trying to target you to steal your identity and open up loans and credit cards in your name. And then you also have people that are potentially trying to physically hurt you.
So we're getting a little scared, our end of the phone line here. Should we just give up this whole internet thing?
Absolutely not. Social media is one of the most powerful tools that we have at our fingertips. We have access to people we never had access to before. We have access to experts in our field. We have instant lines of communication. But you have to understand the risks, and you have to understand the threats to the things that you post. And if you manage that properly, you can really use this tool for success.
Well, let's talk hygiene here. What are a few of the basics that we should be doing or maybe not doing when we're online to protect ourselves?
Well, you want to be careful about the information that you self-disclose. You want to be very, very careful about information that you self-disclose about children. You want to sort of segregate the sites that you go to. And some sites, the privacy settings are going to be a little stronger than on other sites. For example, if you don't want the two to link. If you're on a dating site and you want to keep your identity private to everyone who has access to that site, you don't want to do things such as use the exact same photograph that you use to your personal social media site, because anyone can very easily do an image search, a Google image search, and find any other photograph anywhere on the internet that matches the one you used on your dating profile, and they'll see your social media and they'll get personal information on you. So that's one thing that you can do to kind of protect yourself. You want to also be careful about using a different username, because if someone does a Google search, they're going to also find your social media site. And again, you want to try to keep those things segregated.
So try to use different images, different names, different whatever you can when you're on one site versus another.
Absolutely.
We're talking with cybersecurity expert Tyler Cohen Wood about keeping our online information and our digital personas safe. Her new book is called Catching the Catfishers. Coming up, we'll talk about who and what catfishers are and also advice to give to kids when they first start using a phone, first start going online. You can join in with your questions about online privacy and safety at 800-642-1234. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or post, if you still have the courage to do so, on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with cybersecurity expert Tyler Cohen Wood about staying safe online, from engaging in safe online dating to protecting ourselves against scams and hoaxes and everything in between. You can join in with your online security and privacy questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tyler, I mentioned earlier, I wanted to get some advice on people whose kids are going online for the first time, maybe getting their first smartphone. What are the steps before you put them in the driver's seat there?
So it's a lot easier to work with a kid when they're just getting their first smartphone than it is to work with a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old who's had their smartphone. They've been using their apps for a while, and they already think that they kind of know the lay of the land. When you're starting off with your kid, the best thing that you can do is sit down with them and go through the different applications that they're going to be installing. And you want to make sure that you're friends with them on all the applications that they're using, that you understand what these applications are, and you also want to inform them about the consequences of some of the things that they might post. But more importantly, you want to teach them how to vet if who they are talking to online is actually who they claim to be.
And that starts to get us toward the title of your book, Catching the Catfishers, catfishing. Tell us what that is.
So catfishing, it was it started off as a documentary, but then it turned into this MTV show called Catfish. And what it is you have people who've been dating for many years online. They've never met each other. And when they eventually meet, it turns out that one person has been lying to the other person. And that term has sort of gone viral with the younger sect. So a catfisher is someone who is not telling you the truth, someone who is lying to you about who they are.
And that could be just, someone in your peer group who is trying to make themselves look better or different than they are. It could be, however, more dangerous than that. Can you talk about some of the risks there?
Absolutely. It could be someone who's just adding a couple of inches to their height or taking away a few pounds. But it could also be a predator who is targeting your child, who is claiming to be, a 13 or a 16-year-old boy, but is actually a 47-year-old man. So it's imperative. In the book, I actually have a Catching the Catfishers checklist that teaches you how to vet if people really are who they say they are. And it is very important to go through that checklist with your child. I had a friend, it was a neighbor, whose 16-year-old daughter started dating a guy online, and he claimed he was 16. And the father was involved, he was invested in who his daughter was talking to, but he was concerned. And he asked me if he could use his checklist, and they went through some of the topics in the checklist, such as, will this person Skype with you? And in fact, the guy would not Skype with her. Will they send you real-time photos? And that means, will they send you a photo of themselves in their location right away? Or do they only send you one photograph? And it turned out he had only sent one photograph, so I suggested do a Google image search, see if you find that photograph on someone else's Facebook page. And sure enough, they did find that same photograph on someone else's Facebook page, and it was very obvious that the other person's Facebook page was a real Facebook page. They had friends, they had banter with friends, and when the girl told this person she was talking to, she questioned him about this, he disappeared.
So when do you go to the authorities with something like that?
Well, I mean, you can go to the authorities with something like that almost immediately. If you realize that your child is talking to someone who you suspect is a predator, you can contact them right away, especially once you have that type of evidence.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Donna on the line in Milwaukee. Donna, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Do you have a question or a story?
Well, I have a story. I got divorced. It was like 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago. And my ex-husband moved to Germany. He met this person online, and anyway, he is becoming a German citizen, and he is supposed to go through me, according to the courts, to find out what the kids are doing. Well, we also have older children, and the older children, they post photographs and stuff like that. Well, my ex-husband seems to know what we're doing and when we're doing it and stuff like that. And while we were married, he was extremely controlling and domineering. And he's good with the computer stuff. And I'm trying to convince my kids that he can find this stuff out, and they don't understand what I'm saying, that they're like, that's not possible.
Donna, thanks a lot for that call. And I'm guessing, Tyler, that this is not an uncommon story, anything from stalking by an ex to maybe risks of domestic violence related to that kind of stalking.
Unfortunately, it is not an uncommon story. And one step that you can take right now is you can block this person from all of your social media. But you really have to get that message across that this is a dangerous situation to your children, too, so that they block this person from their social media, too. Or you can go a step further, and some social media sites will let you control what you post to whom, and you can put this person, your ex-husband, you can put him in a category where he'll only see some things that you choose to let him see.
Donna, thanks for that call. Still time for your call if you have a question about online safety at 800-642-1234. Tyler, I wanted to also ask you about cyberbullying, mostly an issue for kids in school, school-age kids, though for some adults too. What kind of things should parents be looking for when it comes to cyberbullying?
Well, there's different definitions of what actually constitutes cyberbullying, and the most important thing, if your child is being cyberbullied, whether someone is threatening them, whether someone has done something called facelifting, and this is where a bully creates a website claiming to be your child and posts nasty things about your child, or posts pictures that put your child in an unflattering light. And there's certain things that you can do. And if you want to press charges, whether it's criminal or civil charges, the initial reaction to most parents that I talk to about this book is, well, I know who the person bullying my child is. I'm going to call their parents. But that's not necessarily the first response you should have if you do plan on pressing charges. You want to collect evidence, and you want to use a screen capture tool to actually capture what it is that you're seeing, the entire web page as it is. You want to take copious notes, such as the date and time, and then you can contact the authorities with this information. Now, if you're just interested in having it removed, that's when you can contact the ISP that houses that information, and they will most likely remove it because it's against their terms of service.
But the first step is do that screenshot, capture that information.
Yes, if you plan on pressing some type of charges. And one of the things that, we talk about all these data analytics and all of the, the ISPs, all these applications collecting all kinds of information about us. And we say, it could be a risk to our privacy. But this is actually where it turns out to be a good thing, because you can have the authorities send something called a preservation letter to these ISPs, and what they will do is they will hold that account and they will start collecting all kinds of data from that account. They will see what IP address posted those photographs, if there's EXIF data in those photographs, and all kinds of other information that can help identify who the suspect is.
This almost feels old school, but what about, those old-fashioned email hoaxes, the Nigerian prince sort of thing where you get lots of money if you put in a little money or a bank account number at the beginning? I hope most people aren't falling for that. Are there more sophisticated scams coming our way now?
These scams have gotten so sophisticated. It's no longer the old day scams where you could pretty much determine that it was a scam. I've seen people send these to me all the time. I've seen ones from what looks to be PayPal, from various banks, and what they do, it looks exactly like the real website. Everything about it is accurate, except for there's one little thing missing, like maybe in the domain name and the email address. There's like a little E before the bank name, or something's just a little bit off, but they look really legitimate. And they say, you know, you need to go to this site. It looks just, again, like the real site, and give us your account information. But what I can tell you is that no bank will ever send you an email and ask you to put your account information in. When you get those emails, do not listen to what those emails are saying. Either delete it or report it as spam.
And so if we think, gosh, this really might be a real thing and I'd really like to check that out, obviously you're saying don't click the link. How would we find out that out in a legitimate way?
What you would want to do is you would want to call the number that you have for your bank, and you would want to talk to someone at the bank. You would tell them about what you've seen in the email, ask if this email came from them. Not the number that you see on the website that you're looking at, but the actual number that you have for your bank. You know, even the number that's on the back of your card.
Tyler, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Tyler Cohen-Wood is a cybersecurity expert. Her new book is Catching the Catfishers, Disarm the Online Pretenders, Predators, and Perpetrators Who Are Out to Ruin Your Life. Every Monday at this time, we check out the latest from Wisconsin Life with essays and commentary on what makes life in Wisconsin unique. And the TV incarnation of Wisconsin Life returns tonight.
You can check out Wisconsin Life tonight at 8 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Television. We'll have a link to a full schedule on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now to preview the new season, from urban agriculture to paddleboard yoga, we have Andy Soth. He's a producer over on the other side of Vilas Hall at Wisconsin Public Television. Andy, thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard Wisconsin Life here on the radio side of things for a long time. This is the second round for the TV version. What kind of things are you hoping to accomplish on the TV side of Wisconsin Life?
Well, on the TV version, it's a little bit different. On radio, I think you hear a lot of sort of individual authors kind of giving essays. Here, we're sort of going out across the state and meeting people, showing them in their own sort of setting. And it's about kind of people and their passions, sort of interesting hobbies, or people who are really devoted to issues and causes or their work.
And we want to dive into some of what's going to be on the air tonight. You feature Milwaukee's Will Allen, a national leader in urban agriculture. And in this clip, he talks about his childhood and his path toward a life in farming.
My parents both were involved in sharecropping, and we grew up on a small farm.
While Will grew up on a farm, more and more African Americans were leaving their agricultural roots in the rural South for jobs in northern cities.
We didn't have a lot of spendable income, but the one powerful thing we always had was lots and lots of good food.
Even so, Will was eager to leave the farm behind.
So when I went away to college, decided to go to University of Miami in Florida, where I was the first African-American athlete, I said that I would never go back to farming, and I guess you should never say never.
Sounds like a fascinating piece with a really fascinating guy. What was it like putting that piece together?
Well, it was a really great experience because, I mean, many people know Will Allen, maybe know his farm, Growing Power. But it was a wonderful experience to meet him and be able to sort of tell his story. And what was great about this was I'd done some work with him before, kind of telling more about his work with sustainable agriculture and some of the technology he's doing. But this was a bit more of his personal story and his story of growing up with parents who had been part of the great migration to the North. But fortunately, unlike a lot of African Americans who lost touch with their agricultural heritage moving north, he grew up in a farm in the suburban D.C. area. And as you see in that clip, he said that he wanted to leave. But fortunately for all of us, he's returned.
Great story. And he also does get down and dirty. We'll listen to him talk some about the worms that he works with.
I always say I like these worms because I give you an idea of what they do. This is a perfect example. Inside this banana, this is what they do, the food.
They'll get inside that banana and they'll eat out all of this, and their waste will become the fertilizer.
Fertilizer sold at Growing Power as Milwaukee Black Gold.
And they live very harmoniously together. They're not fighting over food. They're going to enjoy the food. So, and they don't talk to you, you know. Well, they don't talk to you. They talk to me. They won't talk to you.
I love that. He's that feels that close connection with his worms, even. I love the Wisconsin Life pieces we have on the radio. I checked out some of the video you have online on the Wisconsin Public Television sign, and you really are painting a great picture to go along with your story. Tell us what the visual aside brings to the, like, this Will Allen story here.
Well, this is I love this piece because it's rare you're able to just use like a full clip of someone doing something. So as he's talking to the viewer, essentially, he's there digging into his worm pile and actually pulling out a rotting banana and opening up, and you're seeing these worms doing their work. I mean, it was just a wonderful moment. I was so glad I was able to include it, and it really reveals his personality there.
And you've also got a piece on yoga, but yoga in kind of an unlikely place. Let's take a listen.
Three summers ago, I learned how to paddleboard. There was an instructor who knew I taught yoga, and she said, "Wow, Marie, wouldn't it be great if you could teach yoga on the paddleboard?" And I thought, no, that's not possible. How could you do yoga on a paddleboard? And it kind of excited me to a sense of, well, wonder could that be done? Such a playful, fun thing to do. It was a lot easier than I thought.
And Andy, can you give us a visual here? Because I imagine, well, me paddleboarding, ending up in the water a lot, me doing yoga, which I've not done before, it sounds very rickety and unstable. Did it actually look graceful seeing this happen?
Well, Maureen Hebel, who's the yoga instructor, does indeed look very graceful. But it's true that when I went out to videotape her leading a class, that one gentleman did fall in.
Of course.
And then, of course, he contacted me saying, "Oh, I've got to see that video." But unfortunately, I didn't capture it.
Oh,
Andy,
no.
Did you try paddleboard yoga yourself?
I have not even been out on a paddleboard yet, though. I'm planning to this year. Yeah.
You don't want to go in spring. The weather is not quite right. I think it would be a little too bracing.
Right. Well, certainly not if you're going to fall in.
Exactly.
I live by the Yahara River, and I've seen people going by already.
So are you filming or videoing probably from the shore, or are you out in a boat following them?
Well, in this case, I was I was on the shore with a telephoto lens, so we're able to get some nice close-ups and some nice evening light shots. But yeah, I think it'd be a little bit unstable trying to photograph from the paddleboard.
And speaking of water, I believe you've got a surfing piece. We don't have a clip from that one, but what do we learn about surfing on tonight's episode?
Yes, a different kind of board and a little less contemplative. This is an exciting story. It's surfing in Sheboygan, and it's done in the winter because that's when the surf is best. And what's great about this piece is, technology has advanced, so we're able to use these, really tiny, almost indestructible cameras. So they're attached to the surfboard. So it's really like being there, but of course you don't have the cold water.
And we are going to be talking about that on Central Time on Wednesday. We're going to be talking with one of the surfing legends who sort of helped found the scene in Sheboygan there. So some nice crossover. We watched the piece tonight, and we'll talk a little more on Wednesday.
That's awesome.
And what else do we have to look forward to in this season of Wisconsin Life? What's coming down the pipe?
Well, next week I have a piece that I produced that's about a little store in Paoli called Cluck. And it's part of this sort of growing urban chicken movement. And it tries to be the one-stop shop for all your chicken needs, both for feed and coops, but also chicken art. And chicken knickknacks and chicken books. So everything chicken is there. And that was a really fun piece to do.
Do you feel more connected to Wisconsin working on this? Because you're not only just hearing about it, you're getting out and filming it and meeting people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the great part of this job, is the great privilege, is to meet such interesting people doing fascinating things. And it's not just, people who are going to be, in the news or politicians. It's just people interesting, living interesting lives and willing to share them with you.
I was going to say, like, comparing this to doing a news package, does it feel kind of liberating in terms of the topics and the people you get to bring on the air?
Yeah, absolutely. And also in terms of the production style. I mean, you'll see in the Cluck piece that we try some new things with different special effects that are just there for fun that you certainly wouldn't be able to do in a piece about the state budget.
Now, we talked to Garrison Keillor earlier in the show today, and we were talking a little bit about what it means to be Midwestern and how it's sort of this mystery to people on the coast about what the Midwest actually is. And he was sort of saying that we should just embrace it for all that it's worth and enjoy it and celebrate it. Do you feel like doing Wisconsin Life and diving into sort of the microcultures like, you know, Cluck, for instance, that there is a sort of sense of pride and more of a sense of place about what Wisconsin is, that culture is coming into sharper focus?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. But I also think that it's, you know, we're going beyond kind of the cliches of Wisconsin. And I think what I'm feeling is just seeing is kind of that great diversity that all fits in within Wisconsin. You know, for example, I just met on Friday a person I'm going to be doing a story about who's from the nation of Mali in Africa, but he works here as a veterinarian for one of the large dairies. So here's, you know, something we certainly associate with Wisconsin is the dairy industry, but we don't have a sense of how international and multicultural it is.
This is the second round of Wisconsin Life, as we mentioned. What's been the response from viewers so far?
It's been great. It's been great. It's been really, I don't think I've been involved in a program that had such a good reaction. I think a lot of it helps that we had this great groundwork to be partnered with radio and that the name was already out there, so people had an association with it. But the response from our viewers, the calls, they've been really great, and it's really uplifting.
Well, Andy, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about it and sharing some of these clips with us today. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much.
We've been talking to Andy Soth, producer at Wisconsin Public Television, giving us a taste of a new season starting tonight of Wisconsin Life.